The next case is A21-1176, Caitlin Steffenhagen versus Christian Castrillon. Thank you. And we are here for oral argument on that case. I see that both attorneys are ready to go, it looks like. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. You each will have 15 minutes with 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Please state your name when you begin your argument, and if you're ready to begin, you may.
And, Your Honor, what is the court's preference about masks?
If you want to remove your mask when you are speaking, you can do that. Your choice. You may proceed.
Your Honors, I am Barry Edwards. I am here today on behalf of appellant Christian Castrillon. I was in the green room next door watching the previous argument, going over my notes, but it's not that complicated. It's about fairness. The OFP, the Order for Protection hearing on June 9th of 2021, just wasn't fair. And all of us in this courtroom, judges, attorneys, what we're here for is fairness. And the hearing that determined Mr. Castrillon's rights didn't have clear procedures, and it didn't have consistent procedures. To be clear on the facts, because I suspect based on his brief that Mr. Steffenhagen is going to say that the rules were clear. The respondent at this court, it's a little confusing because since it's an OFP back at the trial court, they were petitioner and respondent, they flipped here. But the respondent here asked for an order for protection on June 1st. She got the ex parte OFP, and that was served. There's no dispute that that was served on Mr. Castrillon, the appellant here today. That order had instructions on how to proceed. Those instructions are in my brief in their original font, all bold. And those instructions said, bring your stuff with you. It itemizes some things and says other stuff as well. You should bring...
Counsel, may I just... we're really talking about the video evidence, it seems like, right? The video's on the phone? That's the primary issue?
The primary issue is that Mr. Castrillon was not allowed to submit his video.
Right.
But the only reason I would quibble with that is that Ms. Steffenhagen also submitted screenshots of texts that were not previously filed or served.
Okay, so turning
it's
first...
It's new stuff.
Okay, so turning to the evidence that didn't come in from your client, the videos, as I understand it, that the original... That it wasn't until the very last order, which was received that morning, that it said to email them to the court. Is that the... point that to email them to the court and the other side. That prior to that, it said bring them or whatever. Is that right?
I didn't hear the last thing.
That prior to that, the order said to bring your evidence, but they didn't say to email it. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
Okay. Yes. And so assuming that, and it was known, I assume, to your client that it was a remote hearing conducted by Zoom. Prior to the hearing itself, right? I mean, he knew to log on. So the question is, I guess, how did he plan to present his evidence at a Zoom hearing that's on his phone? What was his plan for doing that? Irrespective of whether if he's told to bring it to the hearing, how was he planning to do that without screen sharing or some other way to actually present his videos?
I'm limited to the record, but in the record, and I'm not going to be able to point you to an exact page of the transcript, but my memory is that he attempted to show a video. I can't tell you if he was going to hold his phone up to the screen or what, but he attempted to show the video and said something like, this isn't working.
Yeah, it wasn't clear to me what that meant. I know there was discussion about logging off and logging on to a different device, and I don't know if it was trying to log onto his phone. It didn't work. It wasn't clear to me from the record what his problem was with introducing the video that he wanted to introduce.
Nor to me.
Okay.
What I know is that he offered a solution.
What was the solution?
He offered then to log on to the Zoom call through his phone,
mm-hmm.
and then he could show the video on the phone, which was the Zoom call. But, you know, we've all been doing these Zoom hearings. I've done hundreds of them, and the technical, for attorneys who are used to introducing exhibits, used to having copies of exhibits, used to laying foundation, used to having everything in triplicate and marked, half the time I have to figure out how the court wants this done in this particular hearing. Just last week, after a hearing in which a video couldn't show, my colleague Max Keller had to walk a couple blocks down the street to give the court, after the hearing, a flash drive with a video on it. So we're all winging.
Yeah,
we're all winging this.
I know it's difficult, but you know, one thing that I have in mind is it sounds like the district court initially said, you know, I appreciate this was short notice mm-hmm. in terms of what the expectations are. Do you want a continuance so you can have more time to be prepared with your exhibits?
And I was looking at that just again this morning, Your Honor, and that exchange is specifically on transcript page 4. And that exchange about the continuance relates to the fact that Ms. Steffenhagen had not served Mr. Castrillon. So that exchange itself reifies my argument that no one's following any particular set of rules here.
Okay.
She.
I'd want to stop you there because, as I understand, you know, the crux of your argument, it's more that this wasn't fair because one side was allowed to do things and the other side wasn't.
Correct.
So you're raising a due process challenge.
Right.
But your analysis is based on a comparison of who was allowed to do what at the hearing. Do you have any law that says that's how you analyze a due process challenge?
Sure. I'd start with Goldberg versus Kelly, which I assume everyone's familiar with. The fundamental requisite of due process of law is the opportunity to be heard. Due process is the opportunity to be heard.
And it's my understanding that when we're faced with a substantive due process claim, we use the test set forth in Matthews v. Eldridge. We first say, is there a protected fundamental right? If so, were the procedures in place adequate to ensure that right? And I don't see in your brief that you've kind of walked through that analysis for us. Instead, you're just using this sort of comparative analysis where it's like, well, she was allowed to do this, we weren't allowed to do this. I'm just not sure that that's a recognized due process analytical framework that can get you relief without using the Matthews v. Eldridge test. Am I wrong?
Well, even if you were, I probably wouldn't say
it. Well, people tell me I'm wrong all the time. I'm just trying to sort through this because I understand the complaint of your client. It doesn't feel like this was fair because different decisions were made and maybe weren't made consistently. But that happens all the time at a trial. And, you know, we don't get arguments from one side saying, well, I should get relief on this issue because you ruled another way for the other party. I mean, that's not how we examine it. We take a look at what the judge did with respect to your client and decide if that's reversible error.
And to be clear, it's not the result that Mr. Castrillon is arguing with. It's whether the result was based on a fair record. So to answer the Matthews question, first of all, I would say it's procedural due process, but this gets back to law school exams that I'm not that sort of give me PTSD, but I think it's procedural due process, and I don't think Matthews applies, and here's why. Matthews has a two-part analysis. Was there a fundamental interest, and was the process fair? And then the second phase has a three-part analysis. What's the private interest, which I think is frankly a restatement of the first prong. What's the risk of erroneous deprivation? So on the first prong, what's the private interest? Well, the whole point of an OFP is to restrict someone's liberty. I think we've got that one nailed. On the second one, what's the risk of an erroneous deprivation?
I don't know of any case law that has held that restricting someone from seeing someone else violates a constitutionally recognized private interest. Do you have any case law for that?
Not on that in particular, but I can articulate some of the interests. Can I quickly get back to Judge Larkin's question?
Sure. Well, I'd kind of like you to answer that question, because if you can't answer...
Okay.
If you can't identify a recognized protected fundamental interest, you can't get past the first part of Matthews.
Sure. I don't have a case to cite on that, but the order for protection, this order for protection and orders for protection in general, limit someone's ability to move about freely. That's almost the definition of a liberty interest. More importantly, as Judge Cutter said at the district court at the end of the hearing, basically you're going to be on a short leash, Mr. Castrillon, with regard to the police. These are orders that police carry around, or I'm sure they don't carry them around with them, but they have easy access to them. He's sort of pre-suspect. There's also a firearms restriction. In Minnesota, the right to hunt is a constitutional right, but once you're under an OFP, you can't have a firearm. There's restrictions. OFPs are promulgated nationally, and I presume internationally, although I've never dealt with it.
You know, these are interesting answers, and the problem I have with them is because none of this was raised in the district court and it's not addressed in your brief, we're hearing it for the first time in oral argument, and that's not how this is supposed to work. I mean, if we want to talk about fairness and procedure, I mean, we have certain operating rules. We generally do not consider claims raised for the first time in the Court of Appeals that weren't raised in the district court. In other words, there's case law that says, for example, in a family law case, that if you didn't raise your due process claim in the district court, you can't raise it for the first time on appeal. And you need to adequately brief and identify the issue. So I'm a little concerned that you're kind of setting forth the proper analysis for the first time here in the courtroom when no one really has a chance to respond to it.
Well, as far as objections at the district court, I mean, both parties were pro se, and Mr. Castrillon certainly didn't use the language that we're familiar with using every day. But he did say on page 57 of the transcript, I'd like to contest this in some way, which I think is a pro se version of, I'd like to make a record that I object to this. Again, on page 59, how do I dispute this in going further? And the court gave him some instructions on how to access a direct appeal to the Court of Appeals. I want to get to why Matthews, I think, doesn't apply,
okay,
which is that the third prong of Matthews is, well, what procedure would be fair? What would be the burden on the government to have more process? And that's where the Matthews framework doesn't apply.
Why?
The procedure that's in the statute, 518B01, I think, it's either 01 or 02, the procedure promulgated in either court order would have been fair if it had been applied equally. He's not disputing, and Matthews is generally applied in this state, and I don't know other states, to pre-hearing deprivations. So I also don't think it's apt for that reason. But any procedure that was consistently applied would have been fair. Well, I shouldn't say any, but either the two reasonable procedures, the one promulgated in the June 1st order or the one sent the morning 23 minutes before the hearing, probably would have been fair if it had been applied to both.
Can I ask why you think it wasn't applied to both? The other evidence that you're complaining came in were text messages that were available to be seen in the hearing, right? Text messages that were available to be seen at the hearing. In other words, the party had a way to actually display the text messages, and then there was no objection to it, as I understand, to their admission by your client. Why is that the same as the court not considering a video that was not brought to the remote hearing in a manner in which the court could actually see it?
I think I've got three answers. Cognizant of time, I've got 5 seconds per answer. One, it just happens that Mr. Castrillon's videos were fundamental. Ms. Steffenhagen's video was a display of property damage. Mr. Castrillon said that his video showed the incident. It would have been fundamental to the court's decision-making process. Second, I lost track of my thoughts, but Ms. Steffenhagen's video.
I didn't understand that her videos came in as exhibits.
Well, it didn't.
Okay.
But what happened was the court said, and this is a pro se gentleman appearing in front of a judge, even though it's by Zoom, it's, heck, I'm nervous here today, right? And the court says to him, well, you stipulate, and I think she used the word stipulate, to the contents of this exhibit. And he's agreeable throughout the whole hearing when Judge Cutter asks him, and for the record, that's C-U-T-T-E-R, when Judge Cutter asks him to stipulate to the contents of Ms. Steffenhagen's video, he does. Had she then asked Ms. Steffenhagen to stipulate to the contents of Mr. Castrillon's video, then it would have been fair, and I don't think we'd be here today.
I see. So you're comparing video to video.
Yeah.
All right, not to the text messages that came in. Okay, thanks.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel?
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, my name is John Steffenhagen. I'm with the law firm of Helmuth & Johnson, and I represent the respondent, Caitlin Steffenhagen. Your Honor, this case exemplifies the legislative intent of the Domestic Abuse Act. The district court conducted a full evidentiary hearing. The district court conducted that hearing within the narrow time frame of the Domestic Abuse Act. The district court accepted evidence and gave notice to the parties in precisely the same manner, and the court rendered written findings in conformance with the definition of abuse under the Act. The appeal in this case should be denied for three reasons. Number one, as this court has already noted, the objections that have been made today were waived on appeal because the appellant failed to preserve them. Point two.
Can I ask about that? I was wondering about that. I don't think there's an ability, I didn't double check this, but my recollection is that in OFPs, there's a special proceeding for which post-trial motions cannot be brought. Is there authority for bringing a post-trial motion in an OFP case?
I actually, Judge Smith looked at that.
Okay.
And I didn't find it under the applicable rule of civil procedure. Nor did I find a case that said that. However, any party had the ability to petition a court for anything. And even after this court or the district court rendered its decision, the appellant could have approached the court and sought leave to adduce additional evidence or produce the video that he now claims was so important. He did not do so. To answer your question directly, I did not find explicit case law for the proposition that he could have brought a post-trial motion. But the salient point remains the same. His failure to object before the district court in normal circumstances constitutes a waiver on appeal. Now, the second point is that not only did he fail to raise a constitutional argument before the district court, they failed to raise it on appeal in their opening appellate brief. There is no analysis, as Judge Larkin correctly stated, about the correct constitutional analysis. Point three, even if the appellant had preserved his arguments, and even if it was a constitutional deprivation, he admitted the conduct in this case. The admitted conduct in this case vastly exceeds the standard for domestic abuse, and hence any alleged error would be harmless. Now, point one, there was no objection. Counsel for the first time today says that, well, on page 57, he says, how can I contest this? That was after the court had already rendered its decision against the appellant. So basically what the appellant was saying is, Judge, I disagree with what you just found. How can I appeal? Now, that's not the district court's function to tell a pro se plaintiff how to appeal. Pro se plaintiffs are held to the same standards as parties who are represented by counsel. So that was after the fact. But the point of the matter is this. He didn't object to evidence. He didn't object to evidentiary rulings. He didn't object to the order of witnesses. He didn't object to the order of proof. He didn't object to documentary evidence. As Judge Larkin correctly states, at the very start of the hearing, the district court, in fact, said, would you like a continuance? A no questions asked opportunity for a continuance. Now, they try to flip that back and say it's because my client did something wrong. That's the argument you just heard. The best rejoinder to that is the record. This district court judge had 10 days under the Domestic Abuse Act to conduct the hearing. The appellant had 4 days before the initial hearing to prepare. On the first hearing, he was granted an additional day. On the following day, he was granted the opportunity for continuance and declined. That's a waiver.
So can I ask, I assume it's the case, you don't disagree, that the first direction to email the court with exhibits was received on the day of the evidentiary hearing. That's correct, right?
It is correct, but it's also true that both sides knew precisely the time of the hearing because they had appeared before the district court the previous day.
And what does that tell us, that they knew the time? Why is that relevant?
What that tells us is that the hearing time, the hearing date, was not a surprise to the appellant. He knew that the hearing was going to go forward the following day.
Right, but I think, I mean, this seems to me it's pretty, comes down to the argument is that he did not have fair warning that he needed to email his videos beforehand, I mean, in order to display them. I mean, It seems like this really comes down to that he did not understand, and he wasn't told till that morning, the parties were not told till that morning, that he needed to email his videos in advance of the hearing, and that that information came the day of the hearing. And so I think that's what this is about, that he didn't understand he needed to email them, and then he didn't have a means to show them, right?
Your client,
for whatever reason, because maybe did some homework in advance, emailed it in advance, even though had not been told that by order until that morning, that they were emailed in advance, right?
I think that's fair. It's also fair to say that the Minnesota judicial branch has taken extraordinary steps to inform litigants about how to conduct remote hearings. So this was not an instance in which resources were unavailable to him or that my client had resources that he did not. The difference is my client was diligent and she was prepared and she used those resources and the appellant didn't and is now blaming the process. For example, the website mncourts.gov/remote hearings has a specific section titled, and I'll quote, sending exhibits to the court before the hearing. So the appellant could have availed himself of those resources, and he chose not to do so. And even apart from those publicly available resources, he got a notice before the June 8 hearing and did nothing in response to that as well.
What did that notice say? To come prepared with your...
Correct.
With
yes.
your evidence?
Right. right.
Not how to do it, but to come prepared with it?
Well,
or
precisely.
Or bring your evidence or something
so
like that?
So essentially, they're making the same argument on appeal that the appellant made before the district court when he said, I've received no instruction on how to do this. It was not the district court's function to pause an evidentiary hearing and provide a tutorial to a litigant about how to introduce evidence. The fact of the matter is, the appellant should have been prepared to produce the evidence. He had ample resources to do so, and he chose not to do it. And on appeal, despite his failure to avail himself of those resources, he's now blaming the district court.
At any point in the hearing, did he describe or did the district court ask him to describe what his videos would have shown?
I think that was a sound response to the fact that he couldn't produce the evidence himself. The district court was under no compulsion even to ask him how to produce evidence that he couldn't produce in the first place.
I know, but what I'm saying is, did the district court say to him, well, look, what are your videos going to show me?
Correct.
What do they show?
That's exactly what the district court said.
And so he described them.
He described them.
And the district court later, in ruling on the OFP, said, this self-defense claim is not credible. Was she considering what he described on the videos?
I think she absolutely was, in the following way. The first video, according to the appellant, captured the sound of my client vomiting because of the extreme stress of the abuse. That video, according to the appellant too, captured appellant, quote, panting. That was the sum total of the first video. The second video, he said, captured him trying to jump out a window. Essentially what he was trying to say, I was trying to get away. The court did address that because the court said, you had no reason to be there in the first instance. It is illogical to the point of legally nonsensical for the appellant to say, yes, I was trying to get away, but I did that in the context of ignoring my client's entreaties that he give notice of when he's going to be in the home. He broke down a door. He pinned her to a bed. He physically assaulted her. And his argument now is, I was trying to get away.
So there's no prejudice, is what you're saying?
Without question. I'd say not only no prejudice, I'd say, Judge Larkin, respectfully, the district court did address his argument that he was trying to get away by saying it just doesn't make sense. And it doesn't. It doesn't hold together. So we start with the fact there's a waiver. As this court correctly noted, the appellant did not make a proper argument, even on appeal, regarding the standard for a constitutional deprivation. And the fact of the matter is, there was none. In this case, the court treated the parties precisely the same. So rather than address Eldridge versus Matthews, and rather than address Rue versus Bergstrom, or the other controlling law, what we have here is basically a compendium of accusations and criticisms of the district court. Leaving apart the fact that they don't even address the legal standard, these accusations are misplaced, baseless, and legally eviscerated by the record. First, the timing of the hearing. They complained about the timing. He was given an opportunity for a continuance, turned it down. He had 5 days to prepare, to use as he saw fit, and was thoroughly unprepared. Second, I've noted the publicly available resources that were available to both sides. My client utilized them and was prepared. He didn't, and who wasn't. Third, left with no evidence of unfair treatment, they even devolve to arguments such as, well, there must have been ex parte communications between my client and the district court. They further, of the same ilk, say that the district court was fabricated, inexistent, non-existent technological problems. That does a disservice. It does a disservice to the district court. It does a disservice to my client. And with due respect, it does a disservice to the abhorrent conduct that the appellant perpetrated in this case. There is no evidence that the parties were treated differently. In fact, with respect to the video evidence, it is undisputed the parties were treated in precisely the same manner. Just as the district court asked the appellant to describe his video evidence, the district court did the same for my client, and she credibly had done so, even though in her case she was able and researched and was able to produce the video to the court. So there is no constitutional deprivation. And as I noted, any error would be harmless for this reason. As the district court correctly noted, the evidence in this case was admitted. He didn't dispute any of it. And hence, it is undisputed that his conduct began with sexist comments, misogynist comments, dumping her medications in the toilet, pouring vodka on her bed, sending her a text message that she is about to experience the true blackness, that of which is his soul. And he does that after he sneaks into the basement and cuts her power. He physically assaulted her. He emotionally abused her. It was manipulative. It was controlling. And more to the point, it fit the definition of domestic abuse under the Act. There is nothing to remand here. They did not even file a reply memorandum that correctly stated the legal analysis. Your Honor, it looks like my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Edwards, any rebuttal?
Yes.
It's ironic that counsel talks about my side stooping to this and devolving, where I think the court will see on its own that both in our presentations and in our briefs, all of the ad hominem attacks come from the other side. I didn't think this court was going to be addressing the facts of the OFP, and I'm certainly happy to discuss them, but I don't think that's what we're here for. So the most important point, since I've got such limited time, if I'm only going to get one point.
Well, aren't the facts of the OFP relevant in terms of deciding whether or not the alleged violation prejudiced your client such that he's entitled to reversal? Because even if the videos that your client wanted to show showed exactly what he claimed they would, how would that have helped him convince the judge that he was acting in self-defense in the bedroom?
Well, no one in this courtroom, including me, with the exception of Mr. Castrione, has ever seen these videos. So I don't know. I mean, I assume Mr. Stefanagan hasn't.
Okay, but self-defense requires that the person who's claiming the defense not be the initial aggressor and take all actions to avoid the dispute.
You know, I don't know if that's true. We just had a high-profile national case in Wisconsin where the gentleman, whose name escapes me, showed up somewhere he shouldn't have been with a gun he shouldn't have had, and killed, I think it was two people, and the jury ruled, based on jury instructions, that it was self-defense. So I'm not sure that putting yourself somewhere where you don't have a right to be, and I'm not sure that he didn't have a right to be there, but necessarily.
I'm quite sure the Minnesota law of self-defense requires, for a successful self-defense claim, that the person who is claiming it not be the initial aggressor. And if he admitted that he went to the home, broke through a barricade to get in her room, and then picked up the bar that had barricaded the door, I mean, how is he not the initial aggressor of whatever then transpired in that room?
Two things.
At that point, if the video shows her hit him or something, it's like, well, isn't he the initial aggressor? He broke into the room.
I don't think the record shows that he broke down a door, as Mr. Steffenhagen said. And there was a broken doorknob. I don't know if that happened at that incident or exactly how that happened. But
I thought there was a bar across the door and that he broke through the door.
I know there was a bar. I know that he was holding the bar. That's factually, as far as the door goes, that's what I know.
Okay. But that at that point in time, did he have her permission to be in the room?
There was no OFP at that point, and they both shared the residence at that point. So, I mean, it was his home.
And had he cut the power at that point in time?
I don't think that was the same day, but I'm not clear on that factual point. At some point, he flipped the breaker, according to the record.
Mm-hmm. And had he sent the text message before going into her room?
He had sent text messages, yes.
The one about the blackness of my soul?
Yes.
Just sort of ominous.
Absolutely. But again, I don't think that the ends always justify the means. I mean, I'm a criminal defense lawyer, my day job, if you will. And if we don't just say, well, my client's guilty, so it really doesn't matter what the process is.
Right, but what I'm getting at is
my job is to make sure that
whether or not there's prejudice as a result of the district court not viewing these videos, if what the videos show, I mean, even if the videos show your client getting struck or pushed or something, if he's saying, well, see, she's the aggressor, this was the injuries I inflicted were justifiable self-defense, well, then the question becomes, do you have a justifiable self-defense claim? And to have such a claim, you can't be the initial aggressor. And it sort of sounds like he was the one that went into the room uninvited and stirred this up, which would make him an initial aggressor under the case law. Even if he had a right to be there.
I think the video that he was not allowed to show might answer that question. I wasn't there. I know that he claimed at the district court on the record that his video would show what really happened and would show that he was not the aggressor. At this point, we're accepting facts that were based on only one side's presentation of evidence.
Well, he said, and your time's up, but he said, so the video will show me pleading with Steffenhagen to let me out of the room after I took possession of my cat. It will show I had no violent intent, but to Judge Larkin's point, it doesn't show him getting into the room.
Yeah.
It's afterwards. So, I mean, the judge did let him describe it, but... And your time is up. So thank you both. It's been really good to be back in person and in court.
Thank you, Your Honors. Mm-hmm. Mr. Steffenhagen.
And we will recess to consider the non-oral cases.